From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Republican activist Marvin Liebman has been a party insider and strategist for 30 years. He was one of the founders of the modern conservative movement, along with William F. Buckley. In 1990, he shocked his associates and friends by announcing he was gay. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Marvin Liebman. Also, women's fast-pitch softball, we meet pitcher Kathy Aronson. She's played with the Raybestos Braquettes for 15 years, one of the winningest teams in the league. And John Powers reviews The Best Intentions, a new film written by Ingmar Bergman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has begun a post-convention campaign swing through the South. The president made his first stop in Gulfport, Mississippi this morning, where he asked the crowd of several thousand to clean house in Congress and give him four more years. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Buoyed by polls showing him closing the gap with his rival, a decidedly more scrappy President Bush, in Florida, crowds sweltering in the heat to reject the twin ticket of Bill Clinton and Al Gore. The Bush Quail campaign is clearly running against Capitol Hill. GC is linked to CG, Mr. Bush told the crowd. They are one and the same, Gore, Clinton, and a gridlock Congress. Stressing his foreign policy achievements and blaming the nation's economic woes on an intractable Congress, Mr. Bush is campaigning in Mississippi and Missouri today, two traditionally Republican states where he needs to solidify his base. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Gulfport.
Democrats Bill Clinton and Al Gore headed out today on a campaign swing of their own, a bus tour through industrial cities that have been hard hit by the recession. Clinton called President Bush a great fearmonger on economics and accused him of lying about the Democrats' economic plan. In response to the Republican claim that his plan would amount to the biggest tax increase in history, Clinton asserted that it would raise taxes only for the rich. He said it would not come close to the size of the 1990 tax bill that the president signed. Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore was in Toledo, Ohio, where he told a rally that President Bush's promise of an across-the-board tax cut was unbelievable. Members of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace talks are refusing to leave for the next round of the talks, due to start in Washington on Monday. The delegation should have crossed the border between the occupied territories and Jordan today on their way to Washington. Instead, they returned to Jerusalem after the Israeli authorities prevented five members from leaving. John DeWitt reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian negotiating teams have had problems at the border crossing in the past, but this time their protest has been stronger than usual. The whole delegation returned to Jerusalem, and their chief spokeswoman, Hanan Ashrawi, looking exhausted and near to tears, said they'd been humiliated and harassed. Some in the delegation team, who are under 35, were told they needed special permits to leave for short periods, even though they claimed they'd been allowed through in the past. An Israeli spokesman, though, says four Palestinians had refused to sign a paper which could have resolved the matter in a few minutes. The U.S. State Department has been called upon to help resolve the dispute. It will require a face-saving formula for both sides, but few people expect that there will be any long-term damage to the next round of the talks. For National Public Radio, I'm John DeWitt in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 51 points to close at 3,254. This is NPR News. Environmentalists and anti-nuclear activists charged today that the Bush administration is allowing dangerous nuclear proliferation by permitting Japan to ship plutonium around the world by sea. The Nuclear Control Institute, a private Washington arms control group, released copies of a letter today from the State Department to two congressional committees. The letter said that the United States approves of a Japanese plan to ship weapons-grade plutonium from Europe to Japan for use in nuclear reactors. Critics of the plan say it poses a risk to the environment and a threat of terrorism. California fire officials are hoping to contain a blaze that has blackened 18,000 acres in the state's historic gold rush country. Tui Vu of member station KQED in San Francisco reports.
The stubborn six-day-old blaze is 80% contained thanks to cooler, damper weather. Firefighters expect to fully encircle the wildfire in Calaveras County by tonight. Despite the progress in controlling the blaze, none of the 14,000 evacuees have been allowed to go home. The fire has destroyed more than 50 structures, 42 of them houses. 11 people were slightly injured. California Governor Pete Wilson is scheduled to tour the area today to examine the nearly $6 million worth of destroyed property. Meanwhile, fire crews are busy battling two other fires in Northern California, one in Shasta County that has consumed 8,500 acres and driven at least 2,000 people from their homes, the other a smaller fire in El Dorado County. For National Public Radio, I'm Thuy Vu reporting.
Federal regulators announced today that the Campbell Soup Company has agreed to state the salt content of its soups in most ads that link the soups to a reduced risk of heart disease. In 1989, the Federal Trade Commission accused Campbell of falsely linking the low-fat, low-cholesterol content of most of its soup to a reduced risk of some types of heart ailments. The FTC noted that the ads failed to mention that the soups were high in sodium. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For most of his adult life, Marvin Lieben has been a leading strategist and fundraiser for the Republican Party. He was a founder of several conservative groups, including the American Conservative Union and Young Americans for Freedom. During all that time, Lieben was also living a closeted life as a gay man. 2 years ago, at the age of 67, Lieben announced he was homosexual in an open letter to his friend and fellow conservative, William Buckley, which was published in the National Review. Now Lieben has written a book about his life called Coming Out Conservative. Just as Liebman's book began to hit the stores this week, gay Republicans found themselves under attack at their party's convention in Houston. The Republican platform opposes same-sex marriages and gays in the military. And from the podium, Pat Buchanan said that gay rights is not the kind of change we can tolerate in a nation that we still call God's country. Liebman is part of a group of small and vocal gay Republicans called the Log Cabin Federation that has chosen to stay with their party to work for gay rights from the inside. I asked Marvin Lieben for his impressions of the Republican convention.
Well, this one is built on hatred of other Americans. The other ones was hatred of communism abroad. This is much closer to home. And this is, I really find, you know, in Pat Buchanan's speech, naked bigotry. You know, and it was ugly and mean and terrible. And it's part of the Republican Party can't escape Pat Buchanan. There are too many Buchananites around. And until the president says, I disavow Pat Buchanan, everything he stands for, will the party be saved? But I don't see him doing that.
When you hear the phrase family values, which was certainly expressed in many different ways at the convention, is that a shorthand way for being anti-gay?
Well, it's a shorthand way for being bigoted. Anti-gay is part of it. Family values to me and to any American who's been brought up in my generation means tolerance, love, and acceptance of different people. These people on the family values are preaching intolerance and hatred. It's not family values at all. It's a code word not only against gays and lesbians, but against anybody different than the white Christian minority of the Republican Party today.
How do you interpret what Patrick Buchanan and others have said, including Vice President Quayle, that there's a cultural elite that has a kind of stranglehold on the culture, that there's a cultural war going on?
Well, what they mean by cultural elite, I'm not sure that Dan Quayle means it because I don't think he's sophisticated enough, but cultural elite is another code word for Jews. The Jews run Hollywood. And most Jews are homosexuals anyway, to say. That's what they mean by the cultural elite. It's another code word. And if they mean by the cultural elite the modern free-thinking Americans, that's what they are. Their elite is the Ozzie and Harriet show, or Father Knows Best. That's the kind of TV they like. But the world just ain't that way anymore.
Not every president follows the letter of their party platform, and Patrick Buchanan was defeated by voters in his bid for the presidency. Did President Bush and Barbara Bush make you feel any more welcome in the party?
No, they emphasize the hypocrisy of the party now, to the best of my knowledge. They made nice while the thugs went out and did the real work of the party. They represent the Republican Party. The platform is presumably the basis of the Republican Party today. And the president, if he doesn't follow the platform or doesn't even read it, he's a hypocrite.
If you could have helped to write the Republican Party platform, what would you have included?
You mean on the words that were gays and lesbians?
Yes.
Pretty much what the Democrat platform said. Either I wouldn't have included it at all, or I would have said that we are against discrimination against any group of Americans, no matter what they are.
Do you feel that you're at war with the religious right over the Republican Party, over the future and direction of the party?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a Republican, and I'm a Republican because I've been a Republican for a long time, and I helped the Republican Party for almost four decades. I worked on the Goldwater draft movement, the Goldwater election, right along on just everything. I've suffered the defeats of the Republican Party and enjoyed the triumphs of the Republican Party. So it's my party. The religious right has taken over the social agenda of the Republican Party today. It is my duty, I think, to fight for the party and for the soul of the party. But more important, I feel it's vitally important for gays and lesbians to be in the Republican Party as an open presence. Why? We're a two-party system. We're represented in the Democrat Party. We are not at all visible in the Republican Party. If we're ever to achieve anything, we have to be in both parties.
You're part of an organization called the Log Cabin Federation.
Yes.
And this is a Republican organization made up of homosexuals. What kinds of positions does the Log Cabin Party espouse?
Well, what we fight for is, again, equal rights for gays and lesbians in the country, but particularly in the Republican Party. And what we did at our convention just last weekend, the weekend before the regular Republican convention started in Houston, is we agreed not to endorse the Bush-Quayle ticket, which is unheard of for a Republican organization.
At the convention, there were a number of demonstrations outside of the Astrodome. First of all, what were the issues that were being discussed, and how effective do you think those demonstrations were?
Well, we were not involved in demonstrations because we're Republicans, which means we're button-down collar, Gucci loafer Republicans like everybody else.
That means you don't demonstrate?
No.
Okay.
But the demonstrations, which were effective, were run by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, ACT UP, Queer Nation, and all those groups. Now, the gay community is an organization now and is a cause. And like all causes, you have, like in the Civil Rights Cause, you had Martin Luther King, which was sort of the very centrist thing. And then you had the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and many other groups. And so in the gay community, you have your centrist group, but then you have your terrorists. And I don't use that in a pejorative word meaning at all. These are the guys that go out and demonstrate and focus attention on the thing, make noise, are vulgar, are terrible, but they're very meaningful.
Well,
they're the people who did it in Houston.
Well, do you find that the more activist and gay organizations are helpful to you in your cause for gay rights?
Yes, I think everybody's helpful. Any attention that's paid is helpful. Because of them, from the Stonewall riot, which was almost 25 years ago, gays weren't an issue. Gays are now, every day you open the paper, you see gays and lesbians and articles about them, and it's talked about. This came because people acted.
Some people believe that a gay Republican is really a contradiction in terms. How do you answer them?
I answer with great difficulty.
Is it getting harder and harder to
answer? Yeah, very much so. And I just go back to the fact that I think it is vital and important for gay people to be in the Republican Party, because we're a two-party system and we have to be represented in both parties, just as gay people are in everything. The catchphrase is, we are everywhere. We are everywhere. But we have to be everywhere as open people.
But being that the party is not hospitable to gays and lesbians, why do you continue to call yourself a Republican?
Well, because I want to make it more hospitable to gays and lesbians. And I think it's very well within the realm of possibility. If George Bush, if the ticket goes down to defeat in November, which is very well within the realm of possibility, then there are a lot of pieces to be picked up. And you have good Republicans, like Governor William Weld of Massachusetts, who I would say would be the best sort of Republican candidate for president in 1996.
If Bush and Quayle do win the presidency, what will happen to this issue of homosexuality?
Oh, I think the gay and lesbian community will be under dire attack. I think there are things in the state of Oregon and Colorado to get rid of all laws which protect gays and lesbians and to forbid any new laws. I think that'll go all over the country. The religious right will hold sway. I'm very frightened of that.
I was reading about your organization, the Log Cabin Club, and gays in the Democratic Party have called you, not you personally, but gay Republican self-loathers, or even Uncle Toms. I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah. Well, I heard it from Barney Frank himself, who said, "Hi, Marvin Liebman from the Uncle Tom Cabin Club."
Well, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a mark of ignorance and stupidity, because the leaders of our community, of the gay and lesbian community, have to understand that we have to be in the Republican Party. We have to fight our way in the Republican Party, whether they want us or not. And instead of condemning us, they should applaud us. We can differ tremendously on all sorts of issues, but not on the fact that gays and lesbians have to be represented in the Republican Party. And it's stupid of them to condemn us for that.
What would get you to leave the Republican Party?
Nothing.
Really?
Yeah, on account of, again, I'm an old guy now, and I'm prepared to make the sacrifice to stay in the Republican Party just to maintain a gay presence there. So we're not invisible men and women.
I'm speaking with Marvin Liebman, and he's one of the leading voices in the American conservative movement. He helped to found Americans for Conservative Action, the American Conservation Union, Young Americans for Freedom, the Committee of 1 Million. He's the author of a new book called Coming Out Conservative, and he did come out 2 years ago. The book is about his life, about his beliefs in conservative politics, and about his thoughts on the conservative movement today. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Marvin Liebman, and he's the author of a new book called Coming Out Conservative. You did come out 2 years ago after certainly very long association with the party. What was the reaction from friends of yours in the Republican Party when you did come out?
Well, all my friends, I came out publicly because I thought it was the thing to do, because I thought I could do some good. I came out in 1990 because of the rise of homophobia in the Republican Party and the so-called conservative movement. Before that, the gay issue wasn't an issue. The anti-communist issue was. And I thought I could do something by coming out. The main reason I came out was for me, because I was in the closet for 67 years, and I was stifling. Now I feel liberated and free.
What were your fears about coming out?
I had no fears, really. Over the years, to be loathed and despised by my friends and the straight community. I had the fears that I grew up with. But I realized, thanks to the work of so many people, I needn't be afraid anymore. And so I came out, and the instant, but I mean literally the instant that I came out publicly, that I articulated the fact that I was gay, that's important. People are gay and live gay lives, but don't articulate it publicly. There are so many leading members of the American community in every field of endeavor that their friends know they're gay, they just don't say it. It's important to say it openly, and that was important to me.
And were your fears confirmed?
Well, my conservative friends and was startled that I decided to articulate it. And I haven't been really close to a lot of them, except my friend William F. Buckley, who was my friend and continues to be my friend, but no question whatsoever.
You talk about, in your book, a conversation. Actually, it's you and William Buckley and Ronald Reagan sitting around a table together.
Yeah.
And Ronald Reagan mentions a concern he has about his son.
Yeah, well, that was the Thanksgiving weekend, I guess, of 1976. And I was spending the weekend with Ronald and Nancy Reagan, their young son, Ron, who was a student at Yale, and Bill and Pat Buckley and their son, Christopher. And we'd have our Thanksgiving dinner. This was a Saturday night. And Mrs. Reagan and Mrs. Nancy and Pat had gone off to bed. And I was sitting, I was standing in the kitchen with then Governor Reagan, he was called, and Bill. And we were just talking. And Reagan was at his very best. He's one of the most charming, funny men in the world. And he had us in stitches. He was just telling one story after the other. And then he turned serious. And he said, you know, I've gotten some disquieting news from young Ron. What? Said Bill. He's decided to quit Yale. Quit Yale, said Bill. Nobody ever quits Yale. You know, Bill is the consummate Yalie of all times. He said, yes, he wants to become a dancer. A dancer? Said Bill. And then he turned to me, Reagan, and he said, somehow there's something in the gay community called gaydar, similar to radar. And we emit rays. But he turned to me, the president, and said, aren't dancers sort of funny? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, funny. Reagan didn't want to say the word gay, or he might not have even known that word. And so he was a troubled man talking about his son. I said, no, they aren't all funny. And I talked about Baryshnikov and you know, and the dancers who were great womanizers and lovers of women. And his own friends, Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, and that seemed to calm him. And he went upstairs to tell Mommy, as he called Mrs. Reagan, that all was all right. But at that moment, I felt so sad that I couldn't tell him that I was funny, too.
You seem to be saying that even though you lived a closeted life until 2 years ago, that people assumed you were gay, but they just didn't talk about it.
Exactly. You know, you'd have to be an idiot to have been a good friend of mine. But they didn't say the word. It's, what was it, Oscar Wilde said, it dare not be spoken.
Yeah.
You just, it wasn't articulated. And in the crowd that the Buckleys run around with and that I was very privileged to be with, the rich and famous and celebrated, gentlemen don't discuss their plumbing in public. That's the word.
You describe, as a young man leading a double life, you were a member of the Young Communist League, and you describe at the same time as you were a member of the League going to what you say is seedy movie houses on 42nd Street and having, again, as you describe, amorous encounters with strangers. How easy was it for you to lead a double life?
It was difficult, but I did it because the hormones were dictating what I was doing. And it was most unsatisfying, this sort of seedy I was ashamed of it. That's why I was ashamed of myself each time I had an encounter. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, there were a lot of them. I felt sort of dirty and unclean. And it was, you know, I just hated it. But I did it because my hormones were dictating my life at that time, as most young men and women.
How did you go from having an allegiance to communism to conservatism?
Well, during the 30s, I was a good kid and brought up in a middle-class Jewish home. And the only way at that time that I knew of to be for the good things like love, like not hating Negroes, caring about working people. This was the time of the strikes and so forth. Hating discrimination and unemployment, all that sort of stuff, and depression, was in the far left. There was no other way of doing it. And so I joined the Young Communist League, and I became a Marxist and believed it totally and completely. And I stayed there, although I quit the Communist Party in 1944. I stayed a progressive, worked on the Henry Wallace campaign, and with the Hollywood 10, etc., until I met a woman named Eleanor Lipper in 1951. And it's too long a story to go into now, but basically, she was a woman who spent 11 years in the Soviet gulag in the prison camps and was let out after the war. And she said to me, "Why do you believe in all this?" And I said, "Because I believe basically in peace on earth, goodwill to men, and everybody should be brothers, and workers should get a share of what they earn, and all that sort of stuff." She said, "Well, I believe that too, but the Soviet Union is the antithesis of all this. It's the most evil system in the world."
So she got you to change your mind.
Yeah, it wasn't overnight, but she was the one who articulated it for me. And so I became an anti-communist. Again, not overnight. And it was my anti-communism that got me involved in the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
You're a firm believer in the importance or the supremacy of the individual over any state or political party or religious hierarchy. And and as you write about conservatism, you see privacy as really the cornerstone. Where is this philosophy today, this conservative philosophy that you and Buckley helped to found?
I think it's still around and it's still important, but it's sure not practiced in any area that I know of now. I don't think there's any philosophy, so far as I'm concerned, because I've always been an activist, and I was known sort of in the Marxist term as an agit-prop person, which means agitation and propaganda. I've always been a political activist, and philosophies without a political base are rather useless. So the conservative philosophy, I don't see any political base for it now, although it's still very strong and exists. But until we get a political base for it again, it'll be useless.
Well, do you see yourself starting to build a political base to bring the party back to this conservative idea?
I'm going to be 70 next year. I don't know how much time I have left, but I'll sure do my best if anybody wants me.
Well, but do you see others in the party that also believe as you do?
Oh, absolutely. Sure I do. When and this will happen, I don't know. But the more the state takes over, the more young people will decide they don't like the state taking over and will go back to the basic tenets of conservatism, which is the supremacy of the individual over the state.
Marvin Lieben, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Marvin Liebman's book is called Coming Out Conservative. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. For young girls playing high school or college fast-pitch softball, the dream team has always been the Raybestos Braquettes, a women's softball team that's been around since the late 40s. Kathy Aronson began dreaming about the Braquettes when she was 12. Now she's the team's pitcher and has helped lead the team to 3 consecutive national championships. Up next, we meet Kathy Aronson. And critic John Powers reviews the new film written by Ingmar Bergman, The Best Intentions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush headed to the Deep South this morning as he carried on his campaign from the GOP National Convention that ended last night in Houston. But before leaving Houston, Mr. Bush had a farewell pep talk for Republican officials, urging them to expose a link between Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton and Congress. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Buoyed by the adulation among party regulars over his speech last night, George Bush told a breakfast of Republican National Committee members that the convention has dispelled the gloom and negativism that was hanging over his reelection campaign. He also offered a preview of the Republicans' anti-Clinton war plan.
As I told you last night, I'm going to link the Gore-Clinton, GC, to the gridlock Congress, GC. Put them right together. Put them right in there and don't let them come apart.
Asked by reporters this morning for more specifics on his promise last night for a tax cut if reelected, the president said elaboration was not necessary. He said the plan was easy: tax people less and the government spends less. In Houston, I'm John Burnett.
One day after President Bush accepted his party's presidential nomination, challenger Bill Clinton charged his opponent was a lot more interested in winning reelection than helping the American people. As for the president's pledge for an across-the-board tax cut, Clinton said that promise was as hollow as the 1988 vow of "Read my lips, no new taxes." Speaking today before Detroit's Economic Club, Clinton said a test of family values is not who loves their family more, but whether the candidates worry every day about the nation's children and their future. In Bosnia, UN peacekeepers in the capital have come under attack again by Serbian-backed militia forces. These attacks and the peacekeepers came amid the heaviest bombardment to hit the Bosnian capital in 2 weeks. Malcolm Brabant of the BBC reports.
The most serious assault was the brief but intense mortar bombardment of the Ukrainian barracks shortly after one of their sergeants had been killed by a sniper. Another alarming incident was the humiliation of an armored convoy by a group of Serbian irregulars in bandit country near the town of Tuzla. The Serbs demanded that the UN hand over a civilian truck carrying chlorine for water purification. Despite having armored vehicles and heavy machine guns, they gave in. While the UN has been directly targeted over the past 24 hours, the attacks on Sarajevo civilians have been indiscriminate. 5 mortars fell on the busiest streets this morning, killing 4 people and injuring over 30. 4 people had limbs blown off. The mutilation of Sarajevo continues relentlessly.
Malcolm Brabant reporting from Sarajevo. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped more than 50 points to close at 3,254.79 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has told his nation that it faces a hard winter, but should not be afraid that there will be another effort to overthrow the Russian government. The Russian leader said there is not strong support for people opposed to change and that this year's harvest is better than last. Yeltsin said that he believes that October will be very difficult and then, in his words, political games will start anew. He also said that starting next month, he will push in the Russian parliament for a new constitution. Tropical storm Andrew is becoming better organized and could be a hurricane by tomorrow. Valerie Alker of member station WSFP in Fort Myers, Florida, reports.
At last report, Tropical Storm Andrew was located about 470 miles north of San Juan, Puerto Rico, with sustained winds of about 60 miles an hour. It's moving west-northwest at about 9 miles an hour, but forecaster Ed Rappaport of the National Hurricane Center in Miami says it's possible the storm could turn more toward the west in a day or so.
At this point, it's a little too early to say that any place is going to be threatened. But certainly we're going to be looking out towards the west-northwest, to the west of where the storm is now. Anywhere, actually, from the Bahamas to somewhere in the southeastern United States.
Rappaport says conditions are favorable for the storm to strengthen. Andrew is expected to strengthen to hurricane force within the next 12 to 24 hours. For National Public Radio, I'm Valerie Alker in Fort Myers, Florida.
An earthquake measuring 4.1 on the Richter scale struck the South Carolina coastline earlier today. The quake was centered about 25 miles northeast of Charleston, South Carolina, and was felt hundreds of miles away in Georgia. So far, there have been no reports of either serious injuries or damage. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Each summer, the best women softball players come to Stratford, Connecticut. That's because it's the home of the preeminent team in women's fast-pitch softball, the Raybestos Braycats. It was started in the late 40s as a recreation team for women employees of Raybestos and was named after the brake linings the company made. The company is no longer in Connecticut, and the women now come from all over to play with the team. They've just won their 23rd national championship since 1958. Kathy Aronson has been a pitcher with the Braycats for 15 years with the enviable record of 339 wins and 26 losses. I asked her how she got started.
I started playing competitively when I was 12. I played in a women's fast pitch league because there really weren't any youth leagues for me to play in as a kid. I actually grew up as a youngster playing baseball with the neighbor kids when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. But got to start when I was 12. I was the bat girl and reserve outfielder. Finally got to start playing, really, when I was 13 or 14. Now, so I just kind of mopped up in games that were out of reach. I didn't start pitching until I was 16 years old, which is kind of different than most of the pitchers today who get their starts when they're 8 or 9 years old. So I think that kind of leads into why I'm still playing today. I'm still kind of young as a pitcher.
Well, let me ask you about your sort of neighborhood pickup games. This is the baseball that you played before the fast-pitch softball. Were these co-ed games, boys and girls playing together?
Absolutely. Whoever was in the neighborhood who wanted to play, we had probably a variety of ages, you know, 5-6 years difference between the age groups. And anybody who wanted to play could play. We just kind of drafted each other, and we would play all day long in the summers. So, you know, that was actually my exposure to playing baseball or softball. And then actually I grew up with the dream of being the first major league female player. And I was going to be a Detroit Tiger because I was a big Tiger fan growing up, and still am today. And when I was 12, I had the opportunity to watch the Raybestos Braycats play against our top team from Michigan, the Lansing Laurels. And I really got to see what fast pitch softball was like. And I received my first role models and also got more of a realistic dream of what I was going to be able to accomplish if I worked real hard.
Who were your sports heroes as a kid?
I grew up idolizing several of the Tiger baseball players, Al Kaline and Bill Freehan, Mickey Stanley, Mickey Lolich, also Billie Jean King, because really that was the only female athlete being publicized at that time. Even though I never really played tennis, you couldn't help but have tremendous respect for her. She affected every sport. Every female athlete growing up.
You said you got to see the Raybestos Braycats play for the first time when you were about 12. What did it do to see that level, that kind of fast-pitch softball being played?
I was totally in awe, not only of their athletic abilities and the way they could pitch and hit and throw and field, but also the class and the grace that they displayed on the field. I knew that they were something special, and I think that drew me to them. I also, Joan Joyce is the greatest pitcher of all time, and she was pitching the ball game and totally dominated it, and I sat there and just was amazed that any woman could do the things that she was doing out on the field. So she became my first softball role model and still is my softball idol to this day.
What was she doing on the field?
She's a pitcher. She was striking out probably 18 of the 21, just totally dominating and a tremendously imposing figure. She wasn't all that large, but she just seemed bigger than life out there.
Now, what are the characteristics of fast pitch, and how do you get that fast pitch?
It's like any other sport. You work real hard at it. It's something that it's an acquired skill, not a natural skill. It's the hours that you put in that make you a successful athlete, let alone softball pitcher. Certainly my size, I'm 6'3", helps. I have very long arms and legs, and those long levers produce some extra power that someone who's shorter than I might not have. But it's time and effort and determination. And I think I've always been kind of a stubborn person, so I'm the type that if someone said I wasn't able to do something, I had to prove them wrong.
Did someone say you weren't able to do this?
My high school coach tried to coerce me into pitching when I was a sophomore in high school when I was 16, and at first I fought him on it. I really didn't want to because pitching is not something you excel at immediately. And you sit there and you go through a lot of hard times before you hit the good times. I was walking my first year. I walked something like 12 batters a game and hit 8 others and probably threw 20 wild pitches. And it just wasn't a heck of a lot of fun out there. And when I would think about leaving, he would say, you probably couldn't have done it anyway, and give me a little fight back to say, hey, wait a minute, you don't think I can do this? I'll show you. And, you know, thank goodness he stayed with me, and he realized that would motivate me because, you know, that's why I'm here where I am today. There's no doubt that if he wouldn't have pushed me and motivated me, I wouldn't have stayed a pitcher.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about pitching because it's underhand, and we should make that clear to the audience.
Absolutely. We throw from 40 feet away, which is, compared to baseball, they're at 60 feet 6 inches. We throw a ball that's 12 inches in circumference, and baseballs are 10 inches, so it's a bit larger. And also, we throw underhand. We work with a natural motion of the shoulder. Therefore, we don't have to have the rest that baseball pitchers have to have. I've pitched as many as 5 games in one day. Really, it's just a matter of conditioning. If you have a solid technique and then you're conditioned properly, you can pretty much pitch all day.
Without the kind of wear and tear that a baseball player gets.
Absolutely. I have really had no arm injury or shoulder injury throughout my career. I've been very fortunate. The longevity even in our careers as far as innings pitched, games pitched, are just much greater than a baseball player. Even a 40-year-old baseball player often doesn't have the accomplishments of a 30-year-old softball player.
I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with Kathy Aronson, and for the past 15 years, she's been a pitcher with the Raybestos Braquettes, and they are a fast-pitch softball team, and the team just won the championships. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Fast pitch softball pitcher Kathy Aronson is my guest. I read that you struck out Reggie Jackson 3 times in a row.
Yeah, in 1981, while the baseball strike was on, ABC Wide World of Sports came by and they wanted to feature me as part of the Olympic Festival coverage. And they filmed a day in our lives in Connecticut, and a doubleheader and so on. And it wasn't too interesting. One of the questions during the interview was, had I ever pitched against a major leaguer? And my reply is still my philosophy, was no, because I'm not into this man versus woman thing. I'm into trying to be the best among my peers. And they kind of decided to act on it. So without really asking me, they set it up for Reggie to come out to the Olympic Fest in Syracuse, New York. And they were going to have me pitch to him in front of the live crowd after the gold medal game. Fortunately for me, it rained. Halfway through the gold medal game, they called the game, and the field obviously was unplayable. And so I kind of thought I'd gotten out of it. I knew Reggie was there. We had done an interview, but they arranged for us to have the Carrier Dome early the next morning before we all flew out, and we actually did the confrontation there. Reggie was a great sport, and we're all indebted to him because he brought a tremendous amount of publicity to our sport that we really deserved and we needed. And that was why I agreed to do it as well. It was not anything to try to show that I was better than Reggie, because I know better than that. He's the best in his field, and I'd like to think that I'm one of the best in mine. And it was just simply to show the public really how competitive softball is and what a great spectator sport it really is if it's given a chance.
There's, a piece of fast-pitch softball history where Joan Joyce did the same thing you did with Ted Williams.
Yeah, I think that's where the precedent was set. She pitched to several of the Boston Red Sox back in, I guess it was must have been in the 60s, and was very successful against them. Again, we have to stress it is a very different type of pitch to hit. Speed-wise, it's similar to what they're used to seeing, but the ball can do different things. It's released differently, and the pitchers are much closer to the hitters. So, you know, they're jumping into a totally different field when they jump into trying to hit a softball, just as a softball player probably would have that same difficulty stepping in and trying to hit a baseball.
How did you team up with the Ray Bestos Breakettes?
When I saw them play when I was 12, that became my dream. I can remember thinking to myself, someday I want to play for them. And I saw them once again when I was 17, and it was a totally different group of breakettes. All of Joan Joyce's era had established a professional league, and all of those players had moved on. And there were a bunch of young players playing for the breakettes. In fact, it was supposed to be the end of the breakettes. We weren't supposed to dominate anymore. And a woman who's only a couple years older than I, and now she's my teammate, Barbara Rinalda, was pitching for the breakettes then. She was only 18 years old. And I remember watching them saying, they're still great. Look at this. I mean, they've got a bunch of new ball players, and they're young. I think their oldest player was only 25 or 26, and no one expected them to win the Nationals. And yet I sat and watched that tournament and watched them win. They just knew how to win. It was a tremendous reflection of the sponsor and also of the coach, Ralph Raymond, who still coaches today. And I can remember remarking to a friend sitting next to me saying, someday I'm going to pitch for them. And I can remember looking at me saying, yeah, dream on. Years later, I pitched the national championship game. It was really ironic. I actually just wrote and asked for a tryout, and they said, sure, come on out. And so I paid my own way out there.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, whether you were scouted or whether you had to make the first move.
I was totally an unknown. I wrote them. They had no idea who I was. I came out and I tried out, and quite frankly, all I wanted them to do was to say, practice hard and come back and see us in a year or two. And I never, ever allowed myself to think that they would keep me based on that first weekend of tryouts, but yet they did. In fact, it's still one of the greatest moments of my life was when I was pulled aside after the tryouts saying, and they told me, hey, remember when you come back this summer to bring your passport and whatever, and I'm going, wait a minute, come back? Yeah, we'd like you to play for us this summer. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, you're kidding.
The Breakettes have really the best record in the league. Is there an explanation?
I think there's a very, very simple explanation. We have stability within our organization, and we have a tremendous corporate sponsor. They've been with the team for most of the 45 years that we've been in existence. Actually, it's closer to 50 years now. And also our team is coached by the greatest, I think, possibly the greatest coach of all sport. His name is Ralph Raymond. He's been coaching close to 30 years. His winning percentage is about 93%. He's coached 20 national champions, numerous international championships. When you have the same organization working together every year, you tend to keep the best players playing together with the same team. We have very little changeover. We don't see our players changing teams, jumping from team to team. I've played with some of my teammates for the entire 15 years I've played with the Breakettes. When you have that kind of stability, plus their people we're used to winning. You go out there and we expect to win. If we finish second, it's a real disappointment.
You don't get paid.
No, we are totally amateurs. In fact, only in the last couple of years have we received any U.S. Olympic Committee training grants. Since softball was named an Olympic sport, we have qualified for that. So people who are playing on our national team do qualify for some training grants and also some education assistance grants and so on. But before that, we didn't even get any of that stuff. You play for the love of the game, for the satisfaction that competition can give you, for the chance to kind of find yourself.
But do you think you should get paid? I mean, and do you think that would ruin this love of the game?
I really question it. One of the questions I'm probably asked most often in an interview is, you know, if you were a male and you were successful as you are as a softball pitcher, you'd be making multi-million dollars. And to me, I can't even fathom that, because I know that, you know, the only money I make is I make from Yale University as a softball coach. But I don't know if I would love the game. I think it would be a job then. And softball is not a job. It never has been. It's always been a hobby, a love, a major part of my identity and my life. And I would love to see kids have the opportunity to play professional softball, to have the same opportunities that boys have. I'm not sure, especially at this point in my career, whether it would be the right thing for me. But absolutely, I'd love to see the kids have that same opportunity. I don't know whether or not they would love the game the way I love it, but sometimes that's not always the most important thing either.
You mentioned that you're 6'3".
Yes.
Did that take some getting used to? And I'm wondering, even as a kid, I don't know how quickly you got to be 6'3", but you know, what that was like for you.
I actually hit 6 foot when I was 13. I'm from a Dutch community in Michigan, Holland, that and many people are tall here. So I wasn't totally different, but yet it's tough when you're kids, because boys tend to grow slower than or later than girls do. And so I kind of towered, myself and a couple of the other girls in the class who were also 6 footers, and so we took a little bit of abuse for that. But I've always been very proud of my height. I know it gives me tremendous advantages in life, let alone in athletics. It makes me very intimidating as a pitcher. I think it gives me respect in the business world and in my coaching world. And I wouldn't trade an inch of it. But it took some time to get used to, and it certainly took some time athletically to get used to try to coordinate it all when it happened so quickly.
Can you imagine your life without softball?
It's hard to, and I don't want to, because I want to give back to the sport that's given me so much. So I hope that I'm never totally away from it. I'm starting to be able to imagine it without me being a player. I can kind of see what it would be like not playing in the summer, but I can't imagine being totally away from it. It's just given me so much. It's so much a part of my identity.
Kathy Aronson, thank you for joining us for Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Kathy Aronson pitches for the Raybestos Braquettes. She's also a softball coach at Yale University. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Lynn Neary has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Marty. Well, Linda Wertheimer will be going back over the past week at the Republican convention. She'll be recapping some of the highlights of the convention and some of the major themes that have developed. And I'll be talking with three Republican voters that we spoke with before the convention. We'll be trying to find out what they're thinking now about the GOP ticket. And Noah Adams will talk with New York writer Joseph Mitchell about his new book, Up in the Old Hotel. Mitchell arrived in New York in 1929, and he has many stories about the characters that he's met since then.
Thanks, Lynn. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Swedish filmmaker Ingmar Bergman is known for his dark, bleak investigations of the human psyche, movies like The Seventh Seal and Persona. He hasn't directed a movie since 1984, but he wrote the screenplay for the new Swedish film, The Best Intentions. It won the top prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Critic John Powers says The Best Intentions, which is 3 hours long, is a great 19th century novel of a movie.
The movies have always been in love with love. The classic storyline, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, has been replayed thousands of times. And in nearly all of them, love solves everything. But what if love triumphed and the result wasn't salvation, but catastrophe? That's just one of the questions raised by The Best Intentions, which tells the story of Ingmar Bergman's parents' marriage prior to his birth. His father, Henrik, is a poor divinity student whose life is an agony of loneliness and self-hatred. He's asked to dinner at the happy, worldly home of a bourgeois family and promptly falls in love with the daughter, Anna. Anna, who's beautifully played by Pernilla August, is impulsive and warm-hearted and spoiled, the bright red apple of her father's eye. By the way, Bergman's stalwart Max von Sydow plays her father, and he's never been more exquisitely wry or gentle. To the horror of Anna's mother, who bitterly opposes the marriage, Anna fights for Henrik's love. The lovers overcome countless obstacles. It takes a long, painful battle for the boy to get the girl, or more precisely, for her to get him, since she's the active one. But Bergman is about as sentimental as a scalpel, and their love story has a sharp, cruel twist. After struggling heroically to get married, they find that what keeps them from being happy are their own natures. Henrik grows increasingly rigid and domineering, violent in his righteousness, while Anna longs for the warmth of the happy, prosperous family life she left behind. Both are virtuous, both flawed. And in fact, that's one good thing about The Best Intentions. Nobody corners the market on good or evil. Even Anna's mother, who spends the first 90 minutes as a villain, turns out to have been right. This couple wasn't meant for each other. The Best Intentions is not a great film. It's too long, too studied, and though it may sound silly to say so, too pretty for such emotionally unruly subject matter. But there's something of greatness in it. Director Billy August, who made Pele the Conqueror, gives the film something rare, a genuine vision of life. The movie's almost Olympian in its calm understanding that human beings are buffeted by passions infinitely larger than themselves. Anna and Henrik are like two people walking alone on a barren landscape who get carried along by the same flash flood. And this flood is called love. The movie begins with Henrik refusing to see his dying grandmother and claiming he'll never forgive her for what she's done in the past. In real life, Ingmar Bergman did exactly the same thing to his own dying father. This movie is his belated act of restitution to both his parents and perhaps himself. At 74 years of age, he may finally be rid of his own bitterness. The Best Intentions is a rarity, a movie with something wise to say about all our lives. It shows us that love is easier to come by than forgiveness. For while love is something that happens to you, forgiveness you have to do yourself.
John Powers is a cultural reporter for the LA Weekly and writes about film for New York Magazine. Fresh Air is produced this week by Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, Seuss Boland, Sue Weinstein, and Deborah Beagle. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Artie Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the man who was known as the Kremlin's Americanist, Yorgi Arbatov. He founded and directed the Moscow think tank on the USA and Canada. His new book is The System, An Insider's Life in Soviet Politics. And we meet keyboardist Terry Adams from the band NRBQ. Hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.